The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a very common houseplant is revealing the secret math of plants. And scientists estimate an underground network of tiny fungal filaments would, if placed end-to-end, span 10% of our Milky Way. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. There really is math all around us. A new study examines leaves of a common household plant. For more about understanding the secrets of the Chinese money plant, I spoke with Saket Navlaka, an associate professor at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island.
What got me interested, Lucas, was I was trained as a computer scientist during my PhD. And soon after I was working on my postdoc, there were a couple of papers that were published that demonstrated very interesting algorithmic problems that biological systems were solving. And I'll give you one example. So have you heard of this slime mold building the Tokyo Railway Network?
Yes. And that's where this slime mold, which is this goopy looking blob, kind of is used to create the most efficient pathways to food. And then that's sort of mimicked in the Tokyo subway system, right?
Yeah, exactly right. So when I heard about this experiment, you know, here I'm thinking like we have a top-down human design structure, full knowledge of the goals and the constraints of this system, where people want to go and so forth. And then on the other hand, here we had a single cell, right? Literally mold, a single cell organism, no top-down understanding, no eyes, no brain, no idea where these food sources were, just fully bottom-up distributed computation. And somehow they converge onto solutions that, you know, they weren't the same, but they shared a lot of the same properties in terms of, as you said, the efficiency by which someone can get from A to B, or, you know, how resilient the network was, and so on. And, you know, what's said to me is that, look, if a single cell can do this kind of computation, then biology is just literally a gold mine of algorithms. And I took it sort of upon myself as like my mission to be like, look, you know, biologists who are studying mechanisms of, you know, from DNA replication to slime mold foraging to, you know, plants figuring out where to grow and how to grow to brains learning complex patterns. I mean, it's algorithms all the way down. And it just sort of got me thinking that, you know, this is a perspective that reverses the arrow on the typical relationship between computer science and biology. I mean, typically biologists will come to a computer scientist with some data analysis question of, you know, here I have all this imaging data or sequencing data or expression data. Can you help me make sense of it? But now here I was saying, hey, you know, you have actually interesting algorithms in your brain from this biological system that you're studying. Let me figure out how this thing works. And maybe biology can inform computer science. And, you know, there's been a long history of that. You know, neural networks, genetic algorithms, these things have all been classically inspired by biology. But I think there's been a resurgence of this because of our ability to really do fine experiments, to really control parameters, and to really get at the actual mechanisms by which these systems are solving problems. And so it just sort of inspired me to really think about this way pervasively across all of biology.
So your most recent research is taking a close look at the Chinese money plant. And this is a house plant that I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. Did this research start with you sort of just looking across the room and seeing a house plant and wondering, well, what can I learn about this organism and its patterns that are inside of its leaves?
I mean, it was similar to that. What happened was I had a high school intern who came to me, and we were like trying to come up with some project for him. His name was Elijah Blum in Long Island. And we would worked a little bit on, the architectures of plants, how they branch, how they sort of find sunlight, and so on. And one day he came to my office, and he was taking care of his friend's Chinese money plant who was out of town, and he showed me a picture of the leaf, and he held it up so that we could see it clearly. And what I saw were these veins that were forming on the leaf, and then in sort of close, kind of in the middle of the veins, there were a bunch of these dots. And immediately, as a computer scientist, I looked at the relationship between those dots and the lines or the veins, and I was like, oh, this is a Voronoi diagram. Holy crap. And he wasn't sure what that was, but I we started talking about it, and I explained it, and I'm like, well, how the heck can this? Well, so there were two questions. I'm like, one first is, why does this plant need to form a Voronoi diagram? Second, is it really a Voronoi diagram? And I guess the third is, okay, well, if it is and it's doing it, then how the heck is it doing it?
And
Shortly
Saket, do you mind if I ask what a Voronoi diagram is? I've never heard of the word before.
after. Okay, you actually have it's used all the time, although it's not a very well-known concept. So here's the analogy. Let's say that you had a town with a bunch of schools in that town, and now what you needed to do was to divide the town up into districts, where and everyone in a certain district would be assigned to the school that's in that district. Okay, and so what you basically need to do, polling districts is similar. You have polling locations, and then you need to assign people to go, where is their polling location? And one property that you would like to have is that, anybody who's assigned to a certain poll, lives closer to that polling station than any of the other polling stations that are out there, right? You just want to get to school or get to the polling place as efficiently as possible. So what a Voronoi diagram is, a division or a tessellation of space that has this property, that everyone who lives in a school district is closer to that school than any other school. And it forms these kind of very natural like divisions of space that look sort of like, giraffe pattern, giraffe skin patterns, and other kinds of patterns like that that appear in nature. But the difference in this case was that, unlike a giraffe skin pattern where you have the sort of the boundaries of where the schools are, you don't have the location of the school. Right? There's no like dot somewhere in the middle of every skin patch that corresponds to the location of the school. But in this Chinese money plant, we had both, the veins, which were the edges of these boundaries, as well as like these dots, which ended up being these structures called hydatids. They're important for like gustation on the plant to do gas exchange and so forth. They were visible to us, and so we could actually like do mathematical tests to be like, hey, is this really a Voronoi diagram? And that's sort of what got us going.
Now, this has me thinking of the golden ratio, which I'm familiar with. Is there something related here with the golden ratio?
No, not formally. I mean, the golden ratio has been super attractive in terms of looking at leaf distributions and phyllotaxis and how plants put out different leaves. But here we're just looking at a single leaf and how the venation patterns on that leaf are formed. And just to give you a little bit of history of this problem, I mean, so people have been fascinated with vein structures on plants for centuries, and going back to, I don't know, perhaps even some of the classics like Mandelbrot and Da Vinci and so forth. They were looking at these things, and there's been a lot of mathematical models of it now, but a lot of them produce what are called tree-like structures. So these are veins that are open-ended. They look sort of like tree, like branching tree-like structures, but the ones that we saw on this plant were actually closed loops. So they actually formed, closed polygons that surrounded these schools, so to speak. And despite their prevalence in nature, there weren't any good mathematical models of how you would form these sorts of loopy structures. So it sort of connected a lot of open questions for us in a rather coincidental observation.
This is fascinating to me because it shows that the plant is able to design itself, it's programmed to, in its own genetics, to build the most efficient structures possible, right? So there's these sort of these dots, these schools, as you put it, and then the vein patterns around it. You don't have like an irregularly shaped one, or one is really big and another one is super small, and the boundaries on this one are all out of whack. And then it also makes me think of, I sort of just take the shape of cells and looking, I remember looking at the onion skin under the microscope in sixth grade. And you sort of just take all that for granted and think, oh, well, that's just, how it lined up and that the cell is made by the plant and that's that. But this says that, plants are really programmed, or at least the Chinese money plant is programmed to be efficient in its design.
Absolutely. And like I think it's something that we going back to slime molds and all is that these systems have been evolving for many years, for millions of years, and have been trying to solve problems better. And by better, it could be mean more robustly, more flexibly, more efficiently. But they've had all this time to come up with these really ingenious solutions so that they can, survive on less resources or survive longer and deal better with competition and so forth. And so it's remarkable that long before we even knew what a Voronoi, humans even knew what a Voronoi diagram was, these plants were basically building them.
Have you encountered these diagrams and Voronoi patterns in other plants?
As far as I know, this is the first one that we've discovered that discuss the actual venation patterns on plants. People have looked at sort of other higher level ones where they've looked at so if you look up on a tree canopy looking down, like in a forest, you see all these these trans these sorry these plants that are have some coverage of certain space looking down, and those things tend to form these structures that look Voronoi diagram like. But again, the sort of the centers or the dots are not really there. And so I think this is the first one that we found that's really compelling with both the dots and the boundaries in the venation system.
So bringing it back and the connection to math and computer science, how do you think understanding plants in this case can help us solve problems when we're tinkering around in in computers, not just in looking at plants under a microscope or even just taking a look at photos of leaves?
So one of the interesting things about as we were making these observations, we ended up teaming up with Prashemic, who's also a co-author and sort of a guru on plant development, in particular these models of how veins form. And when we showed this to him, he was like completely fascinated because, he saw a path towards answering this question of how these loopy veins could be forming. And B is it was strange because it departed from a lot of the more traditional models of how these veins form. And the paper discusses all those. I'm happy to get into it if you would like. But one of the things I think we can learn from this is that the typical algorithms for Voronoi diagrams, it requires that you be able to measure distances, right? I mean, it's the basis of how we decide where to put the boundaries. This place is closer to X than Y, so let's put the boundary closer to X. But plants don't have any like rulers, right? They're not going out there and making these measurements and making these like global decisions about where these boundaries should be, right? It's much more like the slime mold, very bottom up, and it's just right, these structures are just arising organically. And in our case, what essentially happens is that you have these waves of auxin. And auxin's a plant hormone that's very commonly used for patterning different structures. And the algorithm ended up being very simple conceptually. It's basically these dots are what are called auxin sources, and when they form, they start this wave of propagating auxin that moves in all directions away from it. So sort of like when you put rocks in a pond, you'll see these waves starting to emanate outwards. Now imagine you have a ton of these rocks and you drop all the rocks roughly at the same time. Then where these waves start colliding with one another are the locations where these boundaries are. And you can sort of see conceptually that if two waves start from two rocks at the same point, the place where they're going to intersect is roughly equidistant in between the two rocks. And so that's essentially what the plant is doing. It's just doing this very simple wave-like mechanism. And then, where the waves collide, it sort of forms a vein. And it ended up being a very elegant way to solve an otherwise complicated and a very complicated problem.
Saket Navlaka is an associate professor at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island. His research is published in Nature Communications. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. What's under your feet may amaze you. Scientists say a dense network of underground fungal fibers placed end to end would stretch for 68 quadrillion miles, an unfathomable number. To learn more about the seemingly unmeasurable network of fungal threads that helps feed plants and sequester carbon, the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Corentin Bissot, a postdoc at the European Molecular Biology Lab.
There is one thing you can measure, indeed, basically in a pinch of soil, which is the total length of filaments. Those filaments are called hyphae. It's a bit of a technical word, but basically you have to imagine a very long and thin tube. You can see it under a microscope. So what people have been doing for years, actually, is go to a place, take a pinch of soil, put it under a microscope, and count the total length of hyphae, so of filaments. And once they've done that, they reported where they took this sample and how many meters they found, basically. What we did together with Justin and all the other authors of the paper is that we collected all these reports. We looked at where these samples were taken from, and then we tried to see what could predict in a given place the amount of filaments there could be. And we base that on multiple information you can get about a place, like the type of soil, the amount of rain you get, the amount of nutrients there is in the soil, the type of plants that are above ground, etc. And we were able to predict, or give some extrapolation or give some prediction of what would be the density in all these places where we haven't measured it. So we sampled very, very sparsely, but we extrapolated all of this sampling to the whole planet based on prediction of what the soil was like in those places.
So what sort of ecosystems or places on the Earth do these fungi networks, thrive in, I would say is a word I can use. And what kind of like ideal conditions does there need to be when it comes to, these fungi thriving and not, I guess, being in ill health, if I could use that as a good term.
Yeah, I mean, health is a quite general term, and it does apply to soil as well, and it's been used in research quite extensively. So first, they need a plant. I mentioned it just earlier, right? And they need a plant that associates with this kind of fungi. As I said, most plants do, and like trees associate with mycorrhizal fungi, so these kind of symbiotic ones, but a different one from the specific one we studied here. So if you have just a forest, a pine forest, likely you will not find a lot of the fungus we're interested in. You will find some other fungi that are also super cool, but not the ones we're interested in. Well, where they will thrive most is actually under grassland. And that's interesting because grassland are usually kind of ignored in conservation because, I don't know, I guess forests are a bit more sexy. A grassland is, seems like, it's just grass, it's just a lawn. But actually, what's happening underground is super, super rich and super active. And that's the case for fungi, but I guess for many other things. So they do like actually grasslands. And that's where generally we found and estimated the highest density over the globe. What they don't like as well is when the environment becomes less favorable for them. And there's multiple components to it. It's not completely easy to know what leads to that. But the good thing with the algorithm I just described is that I said you have many predictors that allow you to predict how much fungus you're going to find in a given soil. And you can also find in which direction a given predictor is going to play. So, for example, you can say, okay, there's a concentration of one of these nutrients in the soil. If there is more of it, is there going to be less or more of a fungus at the end? And if you think about it, the fungus is associated with the plant, but the plant also has its own root system. So to access these nutrients that are also essential to the plant can also use the root system. It's basically also, filaments, a bit less thin, but they also can absorb nutrients. So if there's too many nutrients in the soil, what we find, and that's been known also before, and it's confirmed by our study, then the plant will rely less on the fungus. And there's going to be less density. So if you have more nutrients in the soil, you have less density. So the basically the fungus is maybe a bit less healthy or happy, although that's a bit of already a stretch. And interestingly, what we find as well, and that kind of correlates with that finding, is that a place where agriculture is being made also correlate with less of this fungi in the soil. And there are multiple reasons for it. It's really hard to pinpoint a specific agricultural practice. But if you think about this nutrient idea, for example, well, one thing you do in agriculture a lot is that you add nutrients to the soil. And that's for the reason that you want the plants to grow, but then they rely less on the fungus and the fungus is doing less well.
Right. So, like, my next question was just going to be like, just how important is this fungi to plants? It seems like it is.
I mean, it is. It's been around for 400 million years, right? People think that when plants started arriving on Earth, basically they were just some kind of algae. We weren't really a root system, and the first root system that they ever had was this fungus. The association with the fungus potentially has come before the invention of roots in evolution. Definitely they've co-evolved with this thing for 400 million years, and of course the plants, unlike the fungus, can survive without it. They're definitely doing a better job in many situations when the fungus is around and when the fungus is doing well.
And in the research, I don't know if it was able to really conclude, but I think it was talked about, was like sort of back on this topic of the fungi networks being healthy or not. But are they threatened by anything? Or if these fungi networks are threatened or in ill health, does it cause effects to the surrounding area? Or if it's healthy, what benefits do they provide?
So yeah, that goes a bit beyond specifically what we're able to tell in this one study. I mean, we had a very global scale, so really like talking about this intermediary scale of okay, if the fungus is present or healthy, how much better does it work out for the plant? So what I'm going to say is not based on what we found, but based on just like the general, I guess, logic of it, and also I guess what would be the agreement in the field. So the plants can, survive without the fungus, and in other agricultural setting, they actually survive and do pretty well, I guess, in terms of productivity. But one thing, there's many ways of measuring how well your plant is doing. One is to measure how fast it grows, and another is to evaluate, how much supervision it needed to do so, and also how robust it's going to be to disturbances. So if you stop focusing a bit on productivity and think about these other issues. And for example, can my plant survive if I put a bit, little bit less nutrient in the soil, which could be interesting for many reasons, then the fungus starts being more and more important, because it's been made and evolved in order to provide a plant with nutrients in conditions where those nutrients are a bit more sparse or a bit less available. So if we were, for example, to move to a system in agriculture where we would have lower inputs, then the fungus will become even more important, and the health of the fungus would start to play a bigger role. And there's many reasons why you would want to do that. Well, that's beyond my expertise, but more nutrients in the soil is more greenhouse gas emissions. It's more eutrophization, so it means like this leach to the ecosystems, and you get algae bloom, etc. So there's many reasons why lower inputs. It's also costly, right, to produce. It's gas to produce it. So there's many reasons why you would want to lower it, and then the health of the fungus and it being present starts to matter.
Just the thought of having 68 quadrillion miles worth of fungi is insane. And some people might think, well, why is that important? Like, why is it important to have this and know this and have, 68 quadrillion miles of fungi on the planet?
I mean, to me, it's a bit of some research can have application like applied interest. I don't think in that case that's how I would highlight our work. Some others just change your perspective on how you look at things. And if you think, I mean, I don't want to compare myself to or ourselves to Newton in any kind of way, but like when we started thinking, okay, maybe the Earth is not the center of the universe, but maybe the sun, I mean, maybe the sun is, or of the solar system or whatever. Then that did change the perspective of people on how they think about their planet, about their place in the system. And I think by giving an estimate of the total length of this fungus, so also the total mass, right, it's 5 times the human biomass. You're also shifting the eyes towards thinking, okay, you're going to be walking on a grassland, and it's not just a grassland, it's a grassland with quadrillions of kilometers below that are not only just lying there, they're really active. You have to imagine all the flows happening at the same time and all these tips that are growing. So just all this life that you may not see because it's in the dark and it's very small, making it very visible, I think, can change your perspective of hopefully many people on what's going on there.
That was Corentin Bissot, a researcher at the lab of Toby Keers and a postdoc at the European Molecular Biology Lab. His team's research was originally published in the journal Science. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1864. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to our associate producer, Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.